you speak up a little, please?
Microphone.
Sorry. So rather than looking at middle class, where we need, say, looking at our economies, where the value is from the economies work together, I've opted to present you a vision of the world that is purely practical, and to see how this very much differs from the one you might have. And it would be more difficult to have, but also more true to our knowledge. But before I do that, before I present this view of policy, I will present some rumor terms, which brings us to that position of my opinion. You cannot see the world very much, but the little green patches are the shells of the world. Actually, they are not. They stretch per area per year in little cells of half a degree square. The catch of the world is essentially on the shelves. Open oceans don't really have much density of catch, and they are high values of Peru and of Chile, we know that. We found excessive values of China. And this was because China was over-reporting its catch. We compared this rule-based allocation that we have constructed the catch map with the statistical model. We found that the catch figures submitted by China to FAO were untenable, and concluded that their catch was over-reported by about half. Now, this is an old story by now, but the conclusion is important because it means that the world fisheries catch is declining. Up to now, the world fisheries catches have been perceived as stagnating or oscillating, and or people have added aquaculture to the world catch statistics to talk about fish production. Actually, the world catch is declining, and you can see that particularly well if you remove the catch of anchoveta, of Peruvian anchoveta, which is a forest fish. It's declining by about 300 to 700, half a million tons per year. It has been doing so through the 90s. Recently, the FAO has published a triumphant account of the reduction of bycatch discount. And if this is true, then the decline is more rapid. It's probably not true. There is probably no reduction of bycatch and discount. But probably it's not true. Basically, I think you will have to agree with me, it is not because of declining fishing effort that it is declining. It is because of excessive fishing effort. Now, briefly, we can deal with the ecology that underlies these declines in terms of trophic models, which in here, the only important thing that I will present is the fact that these trophic models contain biomass estimates from bioresources, and they harmonize them. Our students at the Fisheries Center usually construct one or two or several of these models because it's part of the emphasis that we give to this fisheries science. Now they are more complicated than that, but that's an example. And important in these models is that they contain biomasses at various trophic levels. We can combine a number of these models and do exquisitely complicated statistics. For example, we can reconstruct the biomass that occurred during a certain period. Now, this is the biomass of table fish, or fish of trophic level 3.5 to and above, on the shelves of the North Atlantic. This is the biomass now. This is a stark image, but this is nothing but a spatial rendition of the declining
not by the graph that we're used to see. The same thing, for example, if we look at West Africa. I insist these pictures are not just painted. This is data based. For example, the 60 baseline was obtained on the basis of troll surveys, very detailed troll surveys. And in 2000, this was gone. Essentially, one order of magnitude change. And so, when we confirmed what we actually presented earlier, the 90% drop of large fish that Ram Myers and Roy Swan obtained. Lots of people see fit to criticize these results. Actually, you find them everywhere you look. The decline of biomass is about one order of magnitude. And that is with reference to the 50s, the beginning of the century. If you went back earlier in history, the decline would be much larger. The biomass not only declined, but the structure of what remains is modified. The large fish exported first at perfect level 4 to 5, and then the fishery gradually move on to lower trophic levels. These are the juveniles of the big fish, of the prey. There is a ratchet effect where essentially the fishery can never go back. The more habitat is modified in the process, and you end up at the tip of the arrow with zooplankton, jellyfish, and an oxid habitat. This is Chesapeake Bay. This is the Adria. This is actually about 150 dead zones that are gradually spreading that people have every time they are surprised about this, but that are at the end of the arrow. At the end of the arrow is the unpredictability, there is small animals, toxic algae, and so on. And the process then is ubiquitous, unsure. Here's, for example, in the lower curve is the Gulf of Mexico. The upper curve is the southern part of the West Central Atlantic. A good potential development. Globally, the global map of trophic level change essentially shows that it occurs everywhere, and there is a transformation of the world, actually, and the transformation of the ocean from inhabited by large animals to inhabited by small animals. The transformation is not complete, but it's essentially is happening. Now, people advocate for marine protected area, and there are thousands of them spread throughout the world. Together, however, they cover about less than 1% of the world, and about 1/10 of them provide adequate protection. So essentially, 0.1 of the world is protected, of the world ocean is protected. Further, they grow at 5% a year, so we'll never, if we can project this further, we will not reach any of the goals that we set ourselves in terms of Johannesburg, for example, protecting 10% of the world. I'm almost finished with this part. It is possible, obviously, that with oil peaking, cheap oil peaking, it becomes impossible to fish the way we have. And then we will get marine protected area cheap. Obviously, it's possible. But really, this slide will serve as my background as I continue. And now I'm going into prehistory, and you'll forgive me. Homo sapiens is a recent species, about 200,000 years old. But its nature was set long ago, millions of years ago. And that's traditionally argued by the social science that we are a tabula rasa, that we don't have a nature, that the social condition fill up whatever it wants in our minds. But actually it's not so. Evolutionary psychology and evolutionary biology defines our species very much. And we can say that we have a nature, and we are a patch disturbing. Our back like elephants. We disturb the patch, and then we move on to the next patch. The agriculture that was born about 10,000 years, or industrialization, about 200 years or three, or even capitalism, about 300 years or so, have not influenced this and changed that. We lived in small bands of about 20 people, but we owed allegiance to groups of approximately 50, 200 people. That's about the tribe, if you like. Incidentally, all humans outside of Africa, just so you know, descend from one of this group, 200 people, are the origin of all people outside of Africa. This is an interesting fact. You think I'm crazy, but actually you can check if you look at human evolution. Patch disturbers essentially the way we acquire resources, and the cohesion within our group is through essentially status seeking, which is good for your genes, and right, yes, has status in those genes, and strong reciprocity. So human really are social animals, strong reciprocity within the group, and absolutely no qualms about exterminating the other groups. Not necessarily of humans, but certainly of animals that compete with them. So further, humans deplete, they prey, until they don't have anything. All investigations that are empirical in nature completely invalidate the notion of the noble savage that husband the resources. Essentially, resources are liquidated given the technology at hand. And the further the technology, the more liquidation happens. And that is documented in several waves or extermination. For example, wherever human Homo sapiens first arrived, there were waves of extermination. For example, Australia, 40,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, the large marsupials, 20, 30 species exterminated. In America, 14,000 years ago, the Clovis hunters, about 30 mammoths exterminated in 1,000 years. In Australia, in about 1,000, the ancestors of Maori, 11 species or more exterminated. This has not changed. The slide I present is actually a massive megafauna extermination. It's very hard to undo because it has a ratchet effect. Every measure we do to loosen restriction brings the stocks down, but almost none of the measures that we do can bring them up, because they are asymmetrical. And especially because the needs grow monotonously. This is also true in forests. I know you would say North America has more forests than 100 years ago. But globally, this is not true. Globally, we are restoring soils, water, and this is cumulative and global. Now, I doubt that market mechanisms do anything but, should I say, oil the machinery. I don't want, I just don't criticize, but I would argue that it cannot reverse any market mechanism, cannot reverse any of this thing. Left to themselves, therefore, I would argue that this mechanism overran natural systems, and that actually the next, this century, would see us facing big problems of survival on this planet, because the degradation is actually getting more rapid. And I know this is hard for you in North America, but as soon as you get out of this continent, you will see it. I lived a long time in Southeast Asia, and in Southeast Asia you can see the cloud cover change, the forest cover change very rapidly from the 60s when I began going there to now. In combination with global warming, which has the characteristic that I presented, this business is very serious indeed. Now, that's where I'm making controversial. I am taking the World War II as the last good war. I'm going back in time because it's risky. But certainly we can agree that World War II was a good war. The Nazis had to be defeated and so on. And I would argue that at the time, whether you needed airplanes or tanks was determined by military necessities, and that economists were employed only to ensure that these products were brought to the front under the optimal condition. But the question whether they would be built was not asked of them, because this was a question of survival of, if you like, humanity. And I'm now almost finished. I'm arguing that the danger we face, and specifically the danger that this and similar processes represent, is a similar danger that Hitler might have posed 50 years ago, and that we have to question our ability to, how to say, that the cost that this will represent to face those have to be dealt with other than in terms of benefits to firms. I'll stop here. I will later deal with the question you have.